Du Bois had yet to see the African continent until he manufactured the opportunity through a well-connected GOP contact. William H. Lewis, former U.S. Attorney General of New England, persuaded Calvin Coolidge, his Amherst College roommate, to appoint Du Bois Minister Plenipotentiary to Liberia on the occasion of the inauguration of President C.D.B. King. "And now, as a sort of ambassador of Pan-Africa, I turn my face toward Africa," Du Bois informed his readers in the February 1924 crisis. He had sailed from Tenerife in the Canary Islands on Sunday, December 16, 1923, aboard the German freighter Henner, after presiding over meetings of the Third Pan-African Congress in London and Lisbon. On Saturday morning, December 22nd, at precisely 3:22 p.m., Du Bois saw Africa. "So now my great-grandfather saw it 2 centuries ago," Du Bois reflected. The moment was historic for him, a solemn experience few American men and women of color of his generation or even in the next would ever savor. William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, the sixth of his line in America, had returned to the ancestral continent. Chanting Liberian oarsmen rowed President Coolidge's minister plenipotentiary ashore. Du Bois slept that night in the United States legation as the guest of Solomon Porter Hood, Lincoln University graduate and United States minister resident. "I have walked 3 hours in the African bush," he exulted in his magazine, describing a mini safari in mid-January in Jungle Book cliches. "I am riding on the singing heads of black boys, swinging in a hammock. Oh, lovely voices, oh, sweet souls of Africa." The crisis for June 1924 featured Du Bois doffing his pith helmet to the camera as 3 villagers struck dignified poses. Du Bois of Liberia relished each day of his symbolic sojourn in an Africa whose perception was almost as much the product of his 8-year-old book, The Negro, as it was of firsthand observation. Pan-Africanism's origins in the black diaspora elite were never more evident than during his performance in Liberia and Sierra Leone, where a tone of unconscious cultural superiority permeated his carefully crafted statements proclaiming the solidarity of darker peoples. Too many gestures and phrases bore the stamp of the classic European in Africa, as though Cecil Rhodes and Rudyard Kipling were shaking hands with Martin Delaney and Alexander Crummell. No longer the result of a cynical White House favor arranged at his own request by a powerful GOP stalwart, his mission to attend the inauguration of President King took on an unprecedented historic and political valence as Du Bois moved among the Liberians. Burdened by foreign debt and threatened by Britain and France on its borders, the tiny republic had been left high and dry without even an official expression of regret after the insurgent United States Senate made a $5 million, scuttled a $5 million development loan. "It was then that the United States made a gesture of courtesy," Du Bois explained. "A little thing, merely a gesture, but one so fine and so unusual that it was epochal. As a means of mollifying a proud, poor people for the insult, Washington appointed him, a Negro, a special envoy, the highest rank ever given by any country to a diplomatic agent in black Africa." In the opinion of the State Department, their special envoy, went way overboard when he presented his credentials to the President of the Republic of Liberia. To the redoubled delight of President King, Du Bois informed the assembled diplomatic corps that his appointment signaled the Coolidge administration's acknowledgement of the great importance that black rule in Africa held for the struggle against color caste in the United States. This interpretation of Silent Cal's Africa policy was news to the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. Senate. British possessions produced 75% of the world's rubber, 70% of which was consumed mainly on the roads in the United States. After the British Parliament suddenly restricted the output of its Asian plantations in 1922, rubber hunters from the Firestone Corporation desperately combed their atlases for new sources of supply. When a representative of the rubber company turned up in Monrovia shortly before Du Bois sailed home, the prospect of a much improved Liberian economy through American business investment seemed highly likely. Minister Plenipotentiary Du Bois described his trek into the rubber-producing upcountry with Donald Ross of Firestone and U.S. Minister Hood in suitably momentous accents. "I stood in an enchanted forest at Christmas," he told the readers of the New Republic. "We all saw thick, straight gray trees stretching endlessly about us, and we all saw more than this." But Du Bois had believed that he saw more than his companions. He soon convinced himself that by gaining the ear of Company President Harvey Firestone, he could safeguard the interests of Liberia and advance the influence of the Pan-African Congress movement. Commending a more humane colonial experiment in Liberia than those pursued by the French, British, or Portuguese throughout Africa, Du Bois's three-page letter to Harvey Firestone cautioned that far better results could be gotten out of Liberia if his company hired progressive whites, educated Liberians, and experienced colored Americans for the task. Harvey Firestone's spokesman responded with a cordial invitation to Du Bois to share any further ideas or suggestions. And that was it. There was scant reason to suppose that Firestone in Africa would behave differently from United Fruit and Standard Oil in Latin America or Dole in Hawaii. Yet Du Bois, who wrote about Portuguese depredations in Angola and British machinations in Sierra Leone with tough-minded perspicacity after his return from Africa, faltered when it came to Firestone in Liberia. Liberia was the solitary African promise of sovereign respectability in a mocking European universe of independent states. Liberia, with its mimicry of American political institutions, and notwithstanding the brutal subjugation of the native Liberians by American-descended black rulers, was envisaged by Du Bois as the lodestar of Africa's struggle for independence. This experiment in black self-government had produced four size and unusual number of exceptional men, Du Bois reminded readers of the New Republic. His psychic need for a plausible Negro state among the world's nations was a Pan-African imperative so exigent that it distorted his keen judgment and even caused him to justify the Americo-Liberians' exploitative domestic policies. If Du Bois cannot be blamed for putting Firestone in Liberia, he certainly did a great deal to justify it. Nothing quite like black folk then and now, Du Bois's 1939 History and Sociology of African Peoples had been done before for a broadly educated American readership. In late 1930s America, the proposition that Africans had been serious contenders in the making of history was scarcely credible. Many remembered the words of Hegel that were just alluded to earlier by Professor White. To that end, then, Du Bois committed his genius and vast store of knowledge to contribute an unprecedented scientific study of mankind in Africa without economic axes to grind, without the necessity of proving race superiority, without religious conversion or compulsion. An ambitious work of synthesis and reinterpretation, accessibly, though not simply written, he intended his book to be the popular complement to his delayed project, The Encyclopedia of the Negro. Du Bois's narrative introduced readers to iron smelting in Africa at a time when Europeans made do with stone implements. As the stories circled the great lakes of the continent and swept across its grasslands, surprised readers encountered the vast stone enclosure of Great Zimbabwe and the Shona Kingdom of Mwina Mutapa in the east, then the Mandinka empires of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai in the west, all of them rising before or during the formation of European non-states. The vaguely familiar in Africa reappeared as mulatto Egypt and Semitic Ethiopia, followed by the unfamiliar and fabulous Benin and Dahomey, the Kingdom of the Congo, the explosion into southern Africa of the Zulus, as irresistible as the Borg of science fiction. With the origin and enveloping devastation of the Atlantic slave trade, Du Bois's narrative reached more familiar and a profoundly persistent terrain. As cutting-edge social science, Du Bois's book was flawed by its usage of obsolete and misleading terminology, as well as in its sweeping generalizations and strains of racialized romanticism. "Negro blood," declaimed the author, "is the basis of the blood of all men." Indeed, black folk then and now rested on a paradox, in that its author intended his book's racial essentialism to function in the service of a pluralist vision. For in validating an unknown and remarkable African past, he envisaged a future in which all races could embrace the cultural parity of one another's histories as well as the interdependence of their destinies. July 1, 1960, accompanied by his second wife, Shirley Graham, Du Bois flew to Accra, Ghana, to attend the ceremonies establishing the Republic of Ghana. His refusal to sign the State Department's non-communist affidavit had prevented him celebrating Ghana's independence in person 3 years ago. 34 years after first feeling the Liberian earth of Africa under his feet, Du Bois had returned to the continent not as the honorific token of an almighty United States of America to a debt-ridden, burdened simulacrum of a nation, but as the honored and greatly moved guest of a virile black republic headed by one of his disciples. Ghana was sending its crack British-trained infantry regiments to the former Belgian Congo, and Kwame Nkrumah huddled with Patrice Lumumba in Flagstaff House, attempting to plot a survival course for the overwhelmed Congolese minister. Du Bois, therefore, had little time available to, Du Bois was not able to see Nkrumah until the very end, and there he spoke consistently when his hour came with Nkrumah about the need for a well-endowed social science apparatus dedicated to African problems. On February 15, 1961, a few days shy of his 93rd anniversary, Du Bois received a cable from President Nkrumah informing him that the Encyclopedia Africana project had been accepted and endorsed by the Ghana Academy of Learning. As always, there was work that must be done, and now it was work for black folk not only in the United States, but also for the peoples of Africa. Du Bois's vision, conceit, some would say, carried him past the desegregation of lunch counters and high schools and beyond the cruel dilemma, as he put it, of giving thanks for full citizenship rights accorded under conditions of all deliberate speed to a starring role in a better world trying to be born outside the folds of rapacious capitalism. On October 1, 1961, he applied for membership in the Communist Party of the United States and then departed immediately with Shirley Graham for Nkrumah's Ghana. The United States Supreme Court's decision upholding the constitutionality of the 1950 McCarran Internal Security Act, a model for our current Patriots Act, decided him upon a departing Homeric gesture, a therapeutic apostasy for his countrymen and women of all races and creeds, he might have called it. In one of his last jeremiads before exiling himself to Ghana, Du Bois called for the restoration of democracy in America. "Make it again possible for the people to express their will," he implored. "Today, the rich and the powerful rulers of America divide themselves into Republicans and Democrats in order to raise $10 million to buy the next election and provide you from having a third party to vote for or stop war, theft, and murder by your votes." Ghana received the Du Boises with a warmth and material support that surpassed their expectations. "We come to witness the last act, or the first, of a great world drama," Du Bois mused in Pan-Africa, The Story of a Dream, a memoir begun only a month after arrival in the country. Designated director of the Encyclopedia Africana Secretariat, Du Bois discharged his role as an oracle and symbol consummately until the end came, encouraging the regime with generalities, presiding over an international conference of scholars at the Lagon campus of the University of Ghana, granting audiences in Cantonments Road between afternoon naps and early dinners. He came fairly regularly until early 1963 to weekly veranda gatherings hosted by University Vice Chancellor Connor Cruz O'Brien. On one veranda occasion, when the exuberant vice chancellor raved on about his infamous Congolese nemesis, Moise Tshombe, leader of the breakaway province of Katanga, a student volunteered that Moise Tshombe was another Booker T. Washington. Connor O'Brien never forgot Du Bois's response, recapturing the moment vividly. The old man stirred like a tortoise, putting its head out of its shell. "Don't say that. I used to talk like that," Du Bois insisted, and recalled the chastening words of an aunt to such sentiments. "Don't you forget that that man, unlike you, bears the marks of the lash on his back. He came out of slavery. You were fighting for the rights here in the North. It's tough, but it's nothing like as tough as what he had to face in his time and in his place." On his 95th birthday, Du Bois became a citizen of Ghana, another symbolic decision taken largely because the American embassy refused to renew his passport. The University of Ghana conferred an honorary degree to mark the birthday, and the Nkrumahs came to the Du Bois' home on Cantonments Road for a birthday dinner. When Nkrumah stood to take his leave, Du Bois reached for his hand and held it tightly. "He had but one regret," he said solemnly. I failed you. My strength gave out before I could carry out my plans for the encyclopedia. Forgive an old man." And Nkrumah protested, but Du Bois persisted. He had wanted to do much more, he said quietly. Silence hung over the room, and then Du Bois smiled and said goodbye. The first President of the Republic of Ghana took his leave in tears. On the night before the March on Washington, Du Bois died in his sleep. So, with fitting ceremony, the people of Ghana took their Pan-African Moses down to the sea to entomb him just outside the white walls of a former Danish slave castle on the Atlantic. The Ghanaian Times waxed conventionally metaphorical about a great sage, quote, "sleeping the long sleep in a spot that symbolizes his true return to the home of his ancestors." Yet his burial in the soil of Ghana meant much more than that, as Nkrumah certainly knew and intended his people to appreciate over time. It implied absolution of African peoples from collusion in slavery, not through an alibi or justification, but through a recognition that in selling Du Bois's ancestors into bondage, the Africans who profited were, in reality, no more free than those who ended on auction blocks. As much, if not considerably more, than any other propagandizing intellectual, the man whom the Ghanaian newspapers saluted as an African prophet had shaped and launched upon the rising tide of 20th century nationalisms the idea of the solidarity of the world's darker peoples, of the glories in the forgotten African past, of the vanguard role destined to be played by Africans of the diaspora in the destruction of European imperialism, and finally, as he grew older but more radical, of the inevitable emergence, as he had devoutly wished to see, of a united and socialist Africa. At that time, in what were virtually his last words of warning, Du Bois had written that a body of local private capitalists, even if they are black, can never free Africa. They will simply sell it into new slavery to old masters overseas. Du Boisian Pan-Africanism, then, meant enormously more than the ethnic romanticism of roots traced and celebrated. The message delivered by Du Bois to all Africans, as to the rest of the less developed world, was that Absent a vigilant citizenry, the market economy perfected in Northern Europe always made the weak weaker and most of the strong weaker. Thank you.